Okay, chapter 13 of The Case for Classical Christian Education is called The Paideia of God. And this word, paideia, comes from, or my use of it, comes from Ephesians chapter 6, verse 4. And in that place, the Apostle Paul tells fathers to bring their children up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Now, those two words, nurture and admonition, are very close in meaning. And one of them is paideia. Now, there are words that are common nouns, shoelace, boot, chair. And common nouns, common. There are also nouns that are large nouns, big nouns. They're freighted with a lot of meaning. In our culture, a word like democracy would be such a word. To illustrate, if I showed you a three volume set of books that I had these books were written by some scholar on the history of table salt, right? You'd say your first thought I would trust would be something like that poor man, you know. Why did he do that with his life? Why did he spend decades and then produce this three-volume series on table salt? You know, he should get out more. He should ask a girl out. Go buy her a snow cone or something. Do something worthwhile. But if someone spent many years and wrote a three-volume three-volume treatment of the word democracy, you would think, a scholar, you know, someone who's doing important work, tracing the history of an important concept, right? So we would think little of the man who did the three volumes on table salt, and we'd think respectful thoughts of the person who did a three-volume history of democracy. And I use this illustration because I have in my library a three-volume treatment of the word paideia. For the ancients, paideia was a big word like democracy. It was not a little word. It was not a common noun. And the thing that's striking is that the Apostle Paul writes a letter to the Ephesians, and he tells the Ephesian fathers to see to it that their children receive a Christian paideia. That means that he's invoking the whole world that is alluded to by that word. Now, when I tell you what the word involved, this starts to make sense. The word paideia referred to the enculturation of a child into the culture of his people. All right, so the full training, education, enculturation, insinuation of a child into the customs, laws, mores, and history of his people. And obviously, education, what we call education, the 8 to 3, 9 months a year business, is an important part of paideia, but it remains a subset of paideia. So an example of the shaping influence of education would be not just what you're learning in school. I started going to school in the 1950s. And when I was attending school in the 1950s, I remember the classroom, the way the classrooms were. And up in front of the classroom, in the middle, above the chalkboard, in all the classrooms, was a picture of George Washington. There's an American flag, in the corner of the classroom, and there's a picture of George Washington, father of our country, up above the chalkboard. I was doing this in Maryland, Annapolis, Maryland, and I have every confidence that kids going to public school in Oregon were also sitting in classrooms that had a picture of George Washington up above the chalkboard. That was part of the paideia. That was part of the enculturation of the students. The Pledge of Allegiance, all of those things are part of – that's an essential part of what paideia is. Now, the paideia can be false or true. Pagan paideia, when a student went to school in the ancient world, Instead of a picture of George Washington, there would be more likely than not a bust of Homer in the classroom. So you have a certain set of cultural expectations. So a student would walk to school in the ancient world, and to his right would be the temple of the goddess of his city. That the presence of that temple was part of his paideia. The fact that American school children all over the country clamber onto these yellow school buses, or as the educrats call them, motorized attendance modules. So they climb. Why are buses all the same color? Well, that's part of our paideia. So we have a certain routine, we have a certain drill, we have a certain set of expectations, and the paideia that we're being incorporated into is that unified paideia. Now, Paul says in Ephesians 6 to bring your children up into the Christian paideia, the paideia of the Lord. Now, in order for the Ephesian fathers to do this, in order for them to incorporate their children into a Christian paideia, there had to be a Christian culture to incorporate them into. But there wasn't. And so what do? Well, they incorporate their children into a Christian culture anyway, and by so doing, they create that Christian culture, right? And then the next generation has a little easier time of it, and the third generation has an easier time of that. And then by the fourth generation, you have an easier time and a harder time because a lot of the work's done for you, a harder time because you have to keep it off of cruise control. You have to really intend what you're doing. So the Apostle Paul told pagan Ephesian fathers, in effect, to incorporate their children into a Christian culture to build a Christendom that didn't exist yet. And so, by obeying that command, by worshiping the Lord, by bringing up their children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, they successfully built, over centuries, it took centuries, but they successfully built Christendom. And I believe that Christians, parents who take the requirement to bring up their children in the paideia of the Lord are engaged in the very rewarding work of rebuilding Christendom, or repairing the ruins, or building Christendom 2.0. Here are a couple of things I say near the end of this chapter on the paideia of God. Consequently, many Christians involved in modern Christian education need to adopt a more comprehensive vision for education. A Christian education is not a process that dabbles around the edges or tries to improve something in need of radical reformation through a simple rearrangement. We may have seen a student who has a basic problem. He needs to study more. He knows he has a problem and he resolves to do better. He then spends quite a bit of time and energy on reorganizing his notebook. Better grades through putting in notebook dividers. This task, as his mother might point out, is easier than studying. So we shouldn't bustle around the edges. We shouldn't try to rebuild civilization through notebook reorganization. We should get to the work of bringing up our children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. And then second, education reform cannot occur apart from a love of particular things: children, towns, books, subjects, music, and on, to the end of one's life and into the next. Why? God has given us salvation through Christ, who took on his incarnate form during the reign of Caesar Augustus. He grew up in a particular town and suffered under Pontius Pilate. The particularity is central to any right understanding of the Christian faith. This particularity is central to a right understanding of the Christian faith. The transcendent God is not irrelevant to this particular classroom. Individuals matter. Particular subjects matter. Think about it this way. Jesus went to Nazareth High. All right. Jesus graduated in a particular year. He was done with his studies in a particular year. There was a yearbook that had him in it. Jesus had a hometown. He was born in Bethlehem. He grew up in Nazareth. Jesus, ultimate truth, ultimate, the ultimate Savior, the ultimate Messiah, had a mom. and a particular mom, a particular woman. And this is one of the great glories of Christianity, is that we worship Jesus Christ, the visible image of the invisible God, who is a particular universal. He's a particular universal. And this enables us, as we are rebuilding Christendom, as we're building our local school, as we're helping contribute to the health of our small town, wherever it is, we're laboring for particular ends. We are loving particular children, teaching a particular classroom, but we're doing it with God's universal kingdom in mind.
I'm a 2009 graduate of New St. Andrews College, and I'm a commercial property manager.
Three kids at Logos, one at home still, and I do flowers on the side out of our house. When you have these little people that you're responsible to shepherd, you realize I need to know what I'm talking about because they need to have a firm foundation and they need deep roots so that they don't get blown over and that they're ready to stand up for the truth.
I am a programmer. The language aspect of NSA is a fantastic preparation for any sort of programming.
I'm a real estate broker here in town. I think absolutely the perfect education for being in sales of really any kind.
I actually put it to a lot of great use when I was working in the political realm.
I am a pastor in Central Coast, California. Whatever vocation you take, it'll make you take that seriously because you're seeing it through the lens of the sovereignty and lordship of Christ.
For more information, visit us online at nsa.edu.